to talk a little economics for a few minutes. Joining us now is somebody who knows a thing or two about economics. His name is Richard Grossman, professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Wesleyan University in Middletown. Professor, thanks for being here on WTIC.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So we saw this article, I guess it was yesterday, and Ron Paul, the former U.S. congressman and a libertarian, was saying that negative interest rates around the world, that money is so cheap that somehow that's going to spiral the world economy into a bad place. And we thought we'd reach out to an expert and find out, first, what does that mean? And is there such a theory that exists and has any significant acceptance and support, and your feelings on it in general? So can you fill us in?
Sure. I'm not sure I would start with Ron Paul as my main explainer of economics, but look, the interest rates have been very low since the financial crisis about 10 years ago. And every year or two, someone pokes his head up and says, you know, this is going to lead to a bubble. This is going to lead to a crisis.
And what would the nature of that crisis be? How does low cost of money create a bad result? I would think that's just good because it generates economic activity.
Sure. Well, it is great if you're a borrower of money. I think the concern would be that if interest rates are very low, then people will start borrowing money for no particular reason whatsoever, and that will lead to people to, say, borrow money to buy houses, stocks, bonds, real estate, whatever it is.
Speculating,
you mean.
That
will push the price of these instruments up above, or these assets up above what they really are worth, and then eventually everything that goes up must come down so that when this all collapses, that'll lead to another bust. So what they're describing is sort of the possibility of a boom bust cycle.
Okay.
The problem with that is we haven't really seen it, right? We've seen incredibly easy monetary policy for the last 10 years. There's been quantitative easing, which means that the Federal Reserve has gone out and bought bonds, which pushes down the interest rate even more. And 10 years, everyone's been saying, we're going to have inflation. And so far, it hasn't materialized. So while I'm not saying that there may not be asset bubbles in particular assets here or there, I'm not seeing sort of the overwhelming sort of crisis coming down the road that Paul seems to be concerned about.
Well, why haven't those predictions come true? Is there a mistake in their logic, or is it just the complexity of economics that there's so many factors at play that you can't be formulaic in your predictions?
Well, you know, the financial crisis really sort of drew a line through, you know, sort of on a timeline, because before then we had a reasonably good understanding if we increased the money supply, or if we kept interest rates low for long enough, it would lead to inflation. And son of a gun, it's been 10 years, and interest rates have been low, and the government's doing, the Federal Reserve's been doing all kinds of expansionary monetary policy, and it still hasn't happened. So I think the argument or the idea that most economists would say, or that some would say, and that is that the rules have changed. The system is just different than it was before. The economy is not acting the way we would have expected it to act in the 70s or 80s. And so that, I think, would be the difference.
But should we look at that and say, okay, there's something anomalous going on, and those normal feedbacks from certain conditions, that those will be popping up at some point?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to keep our eye on the ball and to think about these things and to not sort of shove them in the drawer and just pretend that there's no possibility that they could come about. But on the other hand, there's been no evidence of an emerging inflation, which was the first thing that everyone was concerned about, is all this money creation was going to lead to tons and tons of inflation, and the inflation rate hasn't really topped 2%. So yeah, I think we want to keep our eyes on the ball, and if we see there are bubbles developing in certain asset markets, that's something to be concerned about, as for people interested in policy and as well as for investors. but that doesn't really mean that it's imminent or that it's happening as we're
speaking. So we can relax and wait till we see some evidence. How about the idea that we're overdue for a recession, and if you don't have high interest rates, then you don't have anything in the boat to throw overboard when you start taking in water?
Right. Well, that is another thing. You know, when interest rates are very low, using monetary policy to ease a recession is always a good idea. The problem is when interest rates are already so low, it's hard to push them down much lower. They have been experimenting with negative interest rates in places. But the thing, the major sort of worrying thing that came out recently was the fact that the yield curve has inverted. That is, short-term interest rates are above higher, longer-term interest rates, and that frequently signals that something is going on, that the macro economy is slowing down. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility, you know, and then when you want to add in all the other uncertainty in our lives, whether or not we're in a trade war with the Chinese, or that's on, or whether or not we're in a shooting war with someone else, which we never seem to know. You know, the market hates uncertainty.
Yes.
And so all this uncertainty, I think, has probably not done the economy much of a service. So,
all right, Professor, hold on one second. We'll get a quick traffic and weather update, and then we'll wrap up. Professor Richard Grossman is here from Wesleyan University, the chair of the economics department. So let's just finish our conversation with Professor Grossman from Wesleyan. What is there about the U.S. economy that we should be looking at and being happy about or concerned about right now, sir?
Well, the labor market is, you know, that what we can feel good about is the unemployment rate is low. Of course, the problem is not all the jobs are great, and we still have increasing inequality. So we have sort of problems in that regard. I'd say in the near term, what we should be concerned about is whether or not we're going to get into a trade war with the Chinese, because this isn't, you know, if you're a farmer trying to sell soybeans to the Chinese, this is just not a good time to be in that line of work, so, or anything else for that matter. So I think the major concerns at the moment are the concerns about the trade war. And again, I say with the policy coming out of Washington is somewhat unpredictable, and the market and the economy hates unpredictability. And so I think that that's potentially a major source of instability in the economy. You've got things going on in Europe. You've got Brexit, all kinds of there are all kinds of uncertainties, and the market and the economy don't like them. And so I think those are the things to be concerned about. I mean, on the positive side, interest rates are very low. If you're thinking of opening a business and you need some capital to borrow to get started, interest rates are very low, and so that might actually work for you.
Since you mentioned inequality, what is the cause of inequality?
Oh gosh, how many hours do we have, Todd? There are a lot of things that it's very hard to answer that in a sort of compact way, but some of it has to do with the social safety net. Some of it has to do with the fact that our policies in cities may not be all that they could be. Some of it has something to do with the fact that our educational system isn't necessarily serving everyone equally, because I think that without access to the skills that people need to get good jobs, we're going to continue to have people who just don't get those skills. So I think having a proper education system and with access for as many as possible is probably one of the best things that we can do. So that's an issue.
How does the social safety net contribute?
Well, you know, again, my feeling is one of the government programs that people have actually, on the right and left, both seem to like is the earned income tax credit. Republicans and Democrats voted to expand that a couple of years ago. And so things like that, which basically reward people for working, it's sort of basically a way of helping the working poor. I think that is the sort of program. I think things that we can do with making college less expensive, so social safety net, including things like Pell Grants, and things that improve access to the skills training and the education that people need to make themselves productive, because it's a new economy. Things have changed. Things aren't the same. The skills that are needed are different. different than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
But I'm confused because...
with these skills, then they're going to be in big trouble.
I'm confused because that was the first thing on your list of reasons for causes of income inequality, I thought. Did I misunderstand? The social safety net, I thought you said.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of the social safety net broadly, and that is I think that federal programs that make universities less expensive and training less expensive are for people who can't afford it are very important. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we don't provide enough of those things, right? The economy has prospered over the last 50, 100 years. The economy has prospered. And for the last 30 to 40 years, not everyone has prospered equally. Now, I'm not saying that everyone should always prosper equally no matter what happens, but when you have a situation where the benefits accrue to one segment of society and then there's another segment of society that's just not reaping the same benefits, people who are working harder and not able to get by, I think that suggests, I mean, we should be able to have social programs and educational programs that give people the tools so that they can get their share of the American dream.
Yeah, so that's my estimation, too, that we have failed to deliver education, which is the primary tool, right? And since we have a one-size-fits-all public education system that's locked in place by bureaucracy and union control and things like that, that I feel like we're hampered in our ability to have this system innovate to the needs of the marketplace. We're still dealing with schedules that go back 100 years ago in an agrarian society because they're locked in place by union rules. And then you have colleges that have been locked into a business model that is not applicable to the times and driving up the cost because of the huge influx of money from the federal government in the form of student loans. And doesn't that also, if we could loosen those two things up so they were market-driven things instead of government and union-driven policies, wouldn't we be much better off?
I think there's a lot we could do about to improve public education in this country. It's true there's a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of that is due to unions. On the other hand, teachers are really not paid all that well in a lot of places in the country. And so I think we want to get the balance right. I think we want to get pay right. I agree with you. I think we need more flexibility in dealing with a lot of these things. The problem is a lot of times. And again, I'm not sort of standing up for or against unions. I think it's you have to come to an agreement where all stakeholders are taken care of. And I think that if we expect a better educational system, we have to think of a way to compensate teachers in a way commensurate with the important work that they do. I don't know how to do that, but I'm not sure that if we just got rid of unions, because on the other side, you've got state and local governments, and so you know.
No, I'm just looking to acknowledge what the problems are, not how we get from point A to point B. But clearly, we need to innovate our education system. And if there are people standing there with their hands up saying, "No way, don't come in this direction," then we can see the cause and effect. We've got systems that are non-responsive and rigged systems that won't let that change. So that's something I think we should have a conversation about. That's all.
That sounds reasonable to me. I think that's right. There are a lot of things that we need to do to work on public education in this country. And you know, things like charter schools. There are. You can see the seeds of things coming up. But you're right. It's not enough. And we need to do more, and it's worthy of a conversation, that's for sure.
All right. Professor Richard Grossman, great to talk with you. We'll invite you on again. Hopefully you'll come.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to come on anytime, Todd.
All right. Professor Grossman, Department of Economics. He's the chair there at Wesleyan University in Middletown. Good conversation. We will reach out to him again.